If I play now.
The Independent Audit Committee was established by charter and receives audit reports and other information from the Denver Audit Office. The committee strives to bring greater clarity, transparency, and accountability to Denver's city government and its residents. It is also responsible for commissioning an annual audit of the city's annual comprehensive financial report. This committee is chaired by Auditor Timothy M. O'Brien.
Call the January 16th meeting of the Independent Audit Committee to order. Amy?
Yes, Jack Greenfall.
Here.
Florine Nath.
Here.
Tim O'Brien.
Here. And we might have Leslie Mitchell shortly. We don't have a quorum yet, but once she's here, we can approve the minutes. Next item is a follow-up on the Denver Police Department operations and staffing report. Sonia, do you want to introduce the team? Any opening comments?
Morning, everyone. So on this follow-up, the manager was Kristen McCormick, a lead was Simon Bakili, and the two senior auditors was Danny Pluid and Juan Gomez Jr., and then Natalia Kidlinski also helped out on the audit, but isn't here with us today. And I was the senior audit manager, so I'm going to turn it over to Kristen to do turn it over for introductions.
Chief, would you like to introduce yourself and the team?
So obviously Chief Ron Thomas, Chief of the Denver Police Department. I brought with me Deputy Chief Joe Montoya and our Acting Director of Strategic Initiatives, Elisa DiTrollio.
Okay.
As Sonia said, my name is Krista McCormick, and I was the manager for the Denver Police Department Operations and Staffing Audit Follow-Up that we are presenting this morning. I want to welcome the representatives from the Denver Police Department and the Denver Department of Public Safety. Thank you for taking the moment to introduce yourselves. I'd also like to take a moment to extend my sincerest thanks on behalf of the entire audit team to the personnel from both the Denver Police Department and the Department of Public Safety. We greatly appreciate you taking the time to meet with us and providing us with information about all of the work you've done since the original audit while conducting the work that you do for Denver and its citizens. Before starting our presentation, I'll now pause for any initial questions or comments.
Let's continue.
And with that, I'll go ahead and hand it over to Simon, who will begin discussing information from the original audit.
Kristen? Beginning on page 4 of the current report, the Denver Police Department and its more than 1,400 uniformed officers strive to keep the public safe through crime prevention and reduction strategies. One of the challenges in recent years has been that law enforcement agencies nationwide have struggled to hire and retain officers. This not only reduces the department's ability to respond to 911 calls timely, but it also impairs officer well-being, which can lead to burnout and turnover. It also limits the time officers can spend building trust and relationships with their communities. We examined how the Denver Police Department has approached this challenge to ensure it is able to effectively serve Denver residents. This was accomplished through reviewing and analyzing policies, procedures, strategic documents, and research conducted using surveys and data provided by the department. Our original audit covered the period of January 1st, 2017, to January 18, 2023, and the original report was issued in June of 2023. As shown in the highlights section of the report, we found the department lacked comprehensive strategic policies and documented guidance, and had not developed strategies to understand and address low retention. We also found the police department lacked documented processes to monitor officers' time worked. Officer access to in-house physical therapy and mental health services was also noted as an area which needed improvement. Our original audit proposed 16 recommendations. Our follow-up procedures found that the department fully implemented 5 recommendations and partially implemented 4 others. While some progress has been made, the department did not implement 7 other recommendations. And I'll pause here for any questions or comments from members of the Audit Committee, Denver Police Department, or the Department of Safety.
I'll say something. So first of all, you thanked us for our our engagement. I just want to thank you all. Obviously, continuous improvement, accountability, transparency, those are, I think, hallmarks of our police department. And so we appreciate the exercise. I think it certainly pointed out the areas where we need to continue to improve, but I think also highlighted for us that we are definitely on the right path. So thank you.
Thank you. Danny will now present the implementation statuses of 7 recommendations made in the audit's first finding.
Thank you, Simon. Beginning on page 1 of the report, finding 1 states the Denver Police Department lacked comprehensive strategic policies and documented guidance to ensure effective operations. We had several recommendations under this finding. The department fully implemented 2 recommendations to measure the success of community policing efforts and to finalize and implement a new staffing analysis. Partially implemented 1 recommendation to prepare, implement, and communicate a comprehensive strategic plan, and did not implement 4 recommendations to develop, document, and implement a comprehensive strategic community policing plan. Communicate the comprehensive strategic community policing plan, review and update the recruitment program, and develop communication procedures. I will review each sub-recommendation before pausing for questions and comments. Continuing on page 1 of the report, risks remain because the 2023 to 2027 strategic plan lacks specific measurable details, which will prevent the department from determining whether meaningful change is occurring. We found the plan did not include estimated costs of the target outcomes, who is responsible for each goal, timeframes for accomplishing these goals, and key performance measures. Department staff said this information is in development. Despite the plan stating an annual accountability report would be posted on the department's performance and transparency webpage, as of October 2024, no report has been added. Finally, we were unable to verify how many department staff have heard and understand the plan. Because the department has drafted a strategic plan, but that plan lacks critical elements identified in our original audit, we consider recommendation 1.1 partially implemented. Starting on page 3 of the report, the community engagement strategic plan did not include environmental factors affecting officers and the department. The plan did not include who is responsible for each of the 3 goals, key activities and milestones, or how the department will gather feedback from the community. Because most of the elements of the original audit recommendation are missing from the community engagement strategic plan, we consider recommendation 1.2 not implemented. As found on page 5 of the report, the department did not provide any evidence showing that the community engagement strategic plan has been communicated to officers, staff, or external stakeholders. Department staff said the plan is discussed in various meetings, but because the meeting discussions are not documented, we could not verify that the plan has been shared or how often. Therefore, we consider recommendation 1.3 not implemented. As noted on page 6 of the report, because the Denver Public Safety Survey was conducted in late 2023, the department was able to identify the community's top public safety concerns and focus their efforts on the geographic areas where trust in police was rated low. The department created a trust patrol program to enhance positive police community contacts and organized events in 13 low-trust neighborhoods to strengthen trust and foster community relation. Therefore, we consider recommendation 1.4 fully implemented. On page 7 of the report, we found the department's strategic recruiting plan lacks many of the steps needed to create a strategic plan, including creating a problem statement, measurable objectives, timelines for meeting goals, how to manage performance, how the department is analyzing, learning from, and acting on the plan, and a program summary. Department leaders said they intend to rewrite the plan to include specific measurements, further examine what goals are not fully within the department's control, and will make sure the measurements for each goal are in the department's control. On page 8 of the report, department staff also said that there is no formal plan or procedure in place for communicating the success of recruiting efforts. Updates on the recruitment program are provided on an as-needed basis to relevant stakeholders. Therefore, we consider recommendations 1.5 and 1.6 not implemented. Lastly, starting on the bottom of page 8, the department created and implemented a staffing model that calculates a district's patrol strength. meaning the percentage of current staff compared to the goal staff needed to respond to calls. The department has also created online reporting options with Denver 911 and implemented an updated triage system for phone calls to reduce officer workload and ease the effects of the civilian staffing shortage. Therefore, we consider recommendation 1.7 fully implemented. I would like to now open the floor for any questions or comments from the department or audit committee members.
Any questions from the committee? Chief, any comments?
Yeah, I'd just like to respond. So as it relates to the strategic plan missing critical elements, you know, we monitor the metrics of our strategic plan very closely and provide real-time updates on our transparency page on our external website. I think it's also important to note that shortly after this initial audit was done, there was a mayoral change, and the mayor brought in some safety goals as it relates to his administration and his priorities. And so we did have to make some shifting in order to make sure that our strategic plan sort of matched what his objectives were. I think we were effective in doing that. I think that I can assure you that our strategic plan and all of our goals and metrics were communicated repeatedly to department staff. I just didn't feel it necessary to have some sort of track documentation of those, you know. And in fact, I think it's quite clear that our department staff was aware of what our strategic plan was and what our goals were, because we met all of those strategic goals. You know, we reduced crime in the areas where we were had committed to reducing crime. We improved public trust. You know, we raised our customer satisfaction from about 70% to about 85%. And so that would seem to indicate to me that we did a good job of of explaining what expectations of our staff was. As it relates to the cost, I mean, you know, our budget is, you know, maintained by the Department of Safety. Obviously, we were allotted money from the mayor's budget, and so there's really not, I think, a way to break out costs for each performance goal and metric. So. And then as it relates to the community policing plan, I would agree that we did not do that. And that is ultimately because, particularly as we shifted and focused on the mayor's priorities, which I think did include some community policing efforts, I think it is most prudent to really roll that community policing plan into our overall strategic plan. Particularly when you understand the fact that really community policing is, I think, an integral part of effective policing. And, you know, whether we're talking about our P&I efforts, our efforts to improve public trust, I think that community policing is embedded in just about everything that we do. So I think it's most prudent, I think, to roll both of those plans into one. And then as it relates to being able to identify and gather feedback from community members, the way that we were able to identify our customer service, customer satisfaction metric is through a tool that we purchased that every time somebody calls 911 from a cell phone, they get a survey, they complete that survey, I review those surveys, and those surveys are tracked, and that's how we were able to capture that 85% of the folks that we come in contact with who respond to that survey indicate that they are either very satisfied or satisfied with their interaction with the police officer. Did we get into the recruiting?
Not yet.
Okay.
Could I ask a question?
Yes.
You know, when it comes to this stuff, I think, you know, it's a moving, the city's a moving target.
Certainly.
And do you think, could, originally you were planning to do a lot of this stuff and you weren't able to do it, or it hasn't been done. I guess the questions that I have are, if we go just so far as we've been, the recommendation 1.2, specific recommendations that were not implemented.
Mm-hmm.
As you're sitting here today, which of those do you plan to implement going forward? And which of those do you think it isn't necessary now that you've gone through whatever you've gone through and all the changes that are going on? Is that a...
Hopefully this answers your question. So I think that our strategic plan speaks more to our values and strategies for achieving our strategic goal metrics. The mayor's team and I identify safety goals for each year of his tenure. I think that those also need to be communicated to staff, and I think that the values and processes contained in our strategic plan, I think, continue to help us achieve those goals. We will continue to build upon our strategic plan, make sure that it is in strict alignment with the mayor's priorities and goals. We will continue to communicate what our strategic plan is and what our specific safety goals are to our staff. We'll also continue to monitor the understanding of that by the outcomes that we are achieving. I think the one specific recommendation that's not implemented that I think I've articulated, that I think that it doesn't make sense for us to create a separate and distinct I know that this was an earlier commitment, but as we continue to think about strategic plans and the communication of our goals to our troops, it doesn't, and the recognition that really community policing is embedded in everything that we do, it doesn't make sense to me to have two separate and distinct plans. And so really rolling those community policing values into our original strategic plan.
Thank you.
Sure. Should we continue?
Yeah. Thank you. Juan will now present the implementation status of the five recommendations made in the audit second finding.
Thank you, Danny. Our follow-up of finding two states the Denver Police Department does not have effective strategies to understand and address low retention begins on page 10 of the report. Finding two had five recommendations. I will go through each of these recommendations and pause for questions. We found that the department fully implemented one recommendation to develop, document, and implement strategies to improve diversity, partially implemented one recommendation to improve response rates and take meaningful action, and did not implement three recommendations to address causes for low retention, develop employee retention strategies, and review exit survey results. While conducting the follow-up, we learned the department applied for funding to develop targeted surveys for current and departing staff. The department was not approved for funding and continues to seek another source to fund their work on identifying causes for and addressing low retention. Several methods of obtaining information from department staff noted in the initial audit still occur, including the department conducting exit interviews and exit surveys administered through the Office of Human Resources. Information obtained through these methods is sometimes used to identify retention trends, but there is no documented guidance for these reviews. Because the risk remains that the department is not able to identify and therefore align strategies to address the primary causes for low retention, recommendation 2.1 is considered not implemented. As of the end of our follow-up work in December 2024, The department does not administer regular surveys to gather attention-focused feedback from officers and staff. However, the department does obtain feedback through several regular ongoing meetings, as discussed on page 11 of the report. Furthermore, to address increasing staff participation and the citywide engagement survey, department leadership planned to increase executive and staff involvement during the next citywide engagement survey, which took place last month in December 2024. Because the department does not administer regular surveys to gather retention-focused feedback from officers and staff, we consider recommendation 2.2 partially implemented. While they await funding, department staff said they started a mentoring program and created an early retention program as employee retention strategies, as discussed on page 12 of the report. Although these programs are intended to increase retention, the department does not have a process in place to identify primary causes for low retention, as described in recommendation 2.1. Consequently, the department cannot determine whether these changes address the current causes of officer turnover. As a result, we consider recommendation 2.3 not implemented. The department plans to develop a new exit interview to identify and address pain points within the department, which we discuss on page 13 of the report. However, no progress has been made in developing this new exit interview since the department is awaiting grant funding. As previously mentioned, the department continues to get feedback from separating staff through exit interviews and Office of Human Resources exit surveys. While feedback is reviewed and sometimes analyzed for trends, there is no process in place to ensure regular review of this information for trends is being conducted. Because the department does not have a documented process to review and analyze trends and feedback from departing officers and staff, we consider recommendation 2.4 not implemented. In response to recommendation 2.5, the department created a racial equity action plan that documents diversity goals with strategies and measurements to achieve these goals, as called for in the recommendation. Furthermore, the department's Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Committee meets regularly to go over relevant matters and to work on specific strategies outlined in the plan. In reviewing the department's diversity data, shown on page 14 of the report, the information they provided showed the department has experienced an increase in some applicants of color, along with an increase in the percentage of women that make up the department's sworn strength. Additionally, over 20% of academy recruits were women in 2023 and year-to-date 2024, based on available data. For these reasons, we consider recommendation 2.5 fully implemented. I will pause here for any comments or questions from the audit committee or department.
Any questions from the chief? Any additional response you want to make?
Yeah, just to provide a different perspective, I suppose. I would say that we are addressing the way that we can ways for low retention. I think first of all, we have been conducting exit interviews for I don't know how long. I mean, I know that HR does them, that we do our own, whether they are separating for retirement or leaving the academy. We collect an exit survey. I review all of those. They are all reviewed and maintained by our professional development unit. And I can tell you anecdotally why officers are leaving the job. I mean, if the officers between years 1 and 5 are leaving this job because it's just not for them. Officers generally between 6 years and 10 years often are leaving either because they've decided to change professions, or more often their families are moving, and so they're moving with their families. And then beyond 10 years, generally they're leaving either to go to another profession or retirement. And I think one of the things that spiked our retention rate, I think our retention rate is below 7. That it had been well over 10. I think it might have even been 14 or 16 at one point in time. And I think that was consistent with COVID, with the all of the civil unrest, the vaccine mandate, and I think one of the things that is I think obscured is the fact that a couple of years ago the rule of 20 the rule of 80 was enacted, which pushed up the opportunity for people to be able to retire. And so that, I think, caused that huge spike. We've seen a significant continuous decline, but nevertheless, we continue to try to identify ways that we can improve our retention. In the academy, we've changed the style of our academy. We have done things on the front end to make sure that we are identifying folks' physical abilities and their academic abilities and making sure that we tailor their academy experience. That has led to a significant reduction in past tests, a significant reduction in people either not graduating the academy or deciding to quit the academy. Again, as I spoke to, our retention rate has decreased. We have had officers, eight, in fact, just in 2024, that left the department for other opportunities and have decided to come back. We have probably four more that are in the pipeline. And I think that, you know, you talked a little bit about the department survey that we participated again for the second time in my tenure. And, you know, one of the things that we've identified in both of those surveys is that communication and understanding policies, being involved in policy development, and also personal development are important to our staff. And so we've developed a policy review committee that is staffed by line level officers. We have partnered with the University of Denver to send line level officers to professional development courses. And so we are investing in our officers at line level, and we have significantly increased our communication to all department members. And on top of that, I think the other thing that that we identified is a desire to be heard. And so I have engaged in a number of podcasts with our union, just recently hosted a town hall with all of our officers, deciding that was a better exercise than what I had been previously doing, which was a Connect with the Chief portal that I responded to questions about probably bi-monthly basis. And so I think that I have been responsive to the things that have been communicated by our officers that I think impact retention.
Thank you. Is the deferred retirement option still available to members?
Yes, and again, that comes, you know, the Rule of 80 comes into play there because you are actually able to drop at a sooner period of time. You know, something though that I think that we have accounted for. I think the other thing that is important to acknowledge is that we're over 90% in terms of our authorized strength, which I think is probably better than most large agencies across the country. And so while we certainly are not fully staffed, it's been a while since we've been fully staffed, we have identified a pathway to get to that fully staffed position, even understanding how through, from a budget perspective, how we can ultimately get to that 1639 that we're ultimately authorized by outpacing our attrition through hiring. This year, our goal is to hire 168 officers.
That's right. 90%, over 90%?
No, I wouldn't say over 90%. I would say at about 90%. You know, like if our authorized strength is 1639, we're well into the 1500s in terms of, and we've got three classes in the academy right now.
Right. Other questions?
No.
Let's continue.
Thank you, Chief Thomas.
Yes.
All right. Kristen will now present the implementation status of three recommendations made in the audit's third finding.
Thank you, Juan. Beginning on page 15 of the report, finding three states the Denver Police Department should improve officers' access to in-house physical therapy and mental health services. We have three recommendations under this finding. We found the department fully implemented two recommendations related to expanding physical therapy and mental health services and communicating the wellness program. This recommendation focused on monitoring participation in wellness programs and was partially implemented. I will review each recommendation before pausing for any questions and comments. Continuing on page 15 of the report, in reviewing recommendation 3.1, we found the police department partnered with the Department of Public Safety to expand access to physical therapy and mental health services. The physical therapy program now has additional therapists, including two who are exclusively dedicated to the police department. Regarding mental health service expansion, an additional vendor was contracted, and officers have a wide range of services available, including mental health counseling, substance abuse treatment, family therapy, and trauma-informed care. These services are offered both in person and online. Therefore, we consider this recommendation to be fully implemented. On page 16 of the report, in our review of the implementation of Recommendation 3.2, we found the department effectively communicates and documents its wellness programs. The department regularly shares wellness information through various channels and also has a dedicated wellness and resiliency website where all relevant resources are noted. This recommendation has been fully implemented. As noted on page 17 of the report, we found that while Recommendation 3.3 has not yet been fully implemented, significant progress has been made in tracking wellness program information. The Department of Public Safety has a wellness dashboard which tracks participation and service usage of wellness programs. The dashboard is less than a year old. Because of its recent development and implementation, the dashboard only has a limited amount of information available, and this information is not yet consistently being used to evaluate program success. The information is used, however, to monitor participation and to support budget and funding requests. Because of the progress made and potential to evaluate wellness programs with the dashboard, we consider this recommendation to be partially implemented. I'd now like to open the floor for any questions or comments.
Questions from the committee? Any comments from the department?
Yes, thank you. Just really quickly, first, I just want to boast on the fact that we probably have one of the more robust wellness programs, certainly the most robust program that I'm aware of. And I mean, I attend major city chief convenings three times a year. And so I'm quite proud of the wellness program that we have developed, both from a physical wellness and wellness standpoint. And while I will agree that that we don't actively seek to monitor participation wholly in those programs, some of that is because of the fact that I'm more concerned with accessing those mental health resources and not wanting to, you know, to chill efforts that we've worked very hard on for like 15 years. The other thing that I think is important to mention is that we do track through a wellness rewards program people that are accessing our wellness program, as well as doing things that we know support wellness through our wellness rewards program. And I think that what is showing impacts of our work are fewer injuries, less loss of time because of those injuries, both from the academy through the end of officers' careers.
Okay. Shall we continue?
Simon will now present the implementation status of the final recommendation.
On page 18 of the follow-up report, finding 4 states that the Denver Police Department has inconsistent processes to monitor officers' time worked. This finding had one recommendation, which was partially implemented. Departmental policy limits the total amount of time officers may work to 16 hours a day and 72 hours per week to reduce officer fatigue associated with extensive overtime. The department handbook grants exceptions to this rule. For example, when an officer's responsibilities require them to extend a scheduled shift, or when the officer needs to appear in court. In interviews with department personnel, we determined that these hour caps primarily seek to reduce officer overwork by limiting the amount of secondary employment, which refers to off-duty jobs officers work through another employer. We found that although the department has a system in place for supervisors to effectively identify violations of officer hour caps, there was no comprehensive documentation of the process as recommended in the original audit report. To gain an understanding of the system, we reviewed information from the officer and supervisor handbooks, common policies and procedures, and conducted interviews with personnel familiar with the process. Staff told us that supervisors learn how to conduct their reviews during training, but we were unable to confirm this as there are no additional materials for that training. As we mentioned, the department has implemented several measures to help supervisors identify excess hours worked by officers. Administrators send out reports on recorded time pending approval and on all secondary employment hours. Within Telestaff, the department's timekeeping system, supervisors can access a calendar view to review officer time, and the department has implemented a color coding system to make secondary employment easy to identify within this view. Even with these aids available, without sufficient documentation to guide supervisors through the review process from beginning to end, the risk remains that supervisors may not consistently identify and prevent officer overwork and related fatigue. As such, we consider this recommendation partially implemented. This concludes our presentation. I will now pause for comments and questions from the Audit Committee or Department Representatives.
Audit Committee? Chief?
Couple of points of clarification. One, as you mentioned, there is a Telestaff manual to make sure that people understand how to manage and monitor officer time. It's also a block of training in our supervisor training that is conducted for all new supervisors. HR, I think, has been a backstop in being able to identify potential violations. I'm not aware of any violations in recent memory, and I think that backstop, I think, sometimes points out errors in entry and not overwork. And I think the other thing that's important to mention is that every member of our police department is ABLE trained, to include our supervisors. Our supervisors go through an additional block of ABLE training. And for those of you that aren't familiar with ABLE, it's Active Bystandership for Law Enforcement. And while I think that it is usually discussed in the context of preventing mistakes, I think it should also be discussed in the context of identifying concerns with officers. So you talk about overwork and how much of our focus seems to be on the fact that on managing people's opportunities and ability to work off duty. I think that that there's an expectation that every supervisor understands that the care of their officers is a responsibility of theirs, and through that ABLE understanding, communicating and taking action on identified concerns, whether like someone being overly tired because of either working too many an extended hour of their normal duty shift, or compiling too many hours of off duty, even if it's within policy.
Thank you. Okay, that concludes the briefing. I appreciate the department and what you do every day. Okay, we're ready for our next briefing. Thank you very much. So while we're waiting, why don't we go back to item two which is the approval of the minutes. Is there a motion to approve
the minutes?
I'll second the motion. Is there any objection to the motion? All right, the minutes are approved. Our next item, Mr. Washington, would you like to join us with your staff?
Yes, I'm sure.
The others go.
Carl, are you ready to go here?
Yes.
Don, do you have any opening remarks?
No.
You do not. Carl, would you like to introduce the team?
Yes, thank you, Audrey. My team and I are presenting the results of our audit work to follow up on our construction audit. The team briefing you this morning includes June Samadi, my lead auditor on this project, and then Alexander Munoz and Jackson Rossmith, both senior auditors on this project. Pat Schaefer also worked on this project. He's our senior here today. So.
Thank you. Bill, any opening comments, and would you like to introduce yourself and the team?
Yes, Phil Washington, CEO of Denver International Airport.
Jim Starling, I'm the Chief Construction and Infrastructure Officer.
Michael Sheehan, Senior Vice President for Special Projects.
Good morning, Greg Haggerty, Senior Vice President, Business Operations. And just a short opening statement, if I could, Mr. Auditor.
Yes.
This audit is the Great Hall project. I think most of you know that Penn was originally built to accommodate 50 million annual passengers. And right now, the end of 2024, we're at around 82. This really, allows us to, the necessity actually to rebuild the airport, which is what we're doing. Contract for the Great Hall was terminated, as you know, a few years ago, and the revised schedule and a revision of the scope of work was introduced. When I arrived here, a few months after I arrived at Den to take over in this command team, we released a after-action report trying to lay out what went well, what went wrong with the termination in the last P3 deal. We have done that. We think we're on a new schedule, if you will, since we presented to the City Council the revisioning of the Great Hall. And since that time, we have been looking to improve all of our processes. I will say that what we have done, understanding that there is always room for improvement, what we have done is brought on on-call construction auditing and advisory services. We have executed an on-call contract to support the services and have started those processes. So I just wanted to lay that out before we got into the audit.
All right, thank you. Carl?
All right, thanks, Auditor Brian. I'll walk us through some background information and the rest of the team will review the recommendations and status. Denver International Airport opened in 1995 in Jefferson Terminal. The airport's main terminal was originally designed to accommodate 50 million passengers a year. And by 2007, passenger traffic had reached this level. Today, Denver International Airport is one of the busiest airports in the world, and airport officials expect passenger volumes to reach 100 million passengers a year by 2032. The Great Hall refers to the main area in Jefferson Terminal that lies beneath the airport's iconic 10th. To ensure the airport terminal could handle future passengers, The project includes updating infrastructure and completing redesigns and renovations to improve passenger traffic flows through the airport's check-in areas and security checkpoints. Originally, the airport contracted with Great Hall Partners in 2018 to start this process. However, the partnership with Great Hall Partners didn't last, and the airport terminated its contract in August 2019 at a cost of $183 million. With the need to continue the construction work that was started by Great Hall Partners, airport officials moved quickly to select new contractors. By October 2019, less than 2 months after terminating Great Hall Partners, the airport had procured a new contractor, Hensel Phelps Construction Company, to take over the active construction site and oversee construction under a revised schedule and a re-envisioned scope of work. The Great Hall project is ongoing, and the airport expects construction to finish in 2028. In total, the project is expected to cost $2.1 billion, and our original audit focused on phases 1 and 2 of the revised project. Denver International Airport's Special Projects Division is responsible for managing and overseeing the Great Hall project. And when the airport procures contractors to build its construction projects, it must also manage and oversee the contractors and monitor contract performance. The objective of our original audit was to determine whether Denver International Airport's Special Projects Division is adequately managing and overseeing the Great Hall construction project to ensure the airport procured its new contractor in a fair, open, and competitive manner, and that the airport is not being overcharged for construction costs. Our scope covered reviewing procurement and construction work occurring in phases 1 and 2, and included the time period August 2019 through August 2022. We issued our original audit report in April 2023 and found the airport did not have a process for project delivery method selection for its construction projects, and it deviated from established processes when selecting a new contractor to take over that project. The airport also lacked policies and procedures to help it manage the Great Hall project consistently and effectively. We also found the airport did not oversee the contractor's subcontracting process, including when it hired itself as a, when the prime contractor hired itself as a subcontractor. Airport managers also did not properly review project allowances and costs to ensure the city was not being overcharged. As a result of our work, we made 10 recommendations. The airport disagreed with 7 of them and agreed to implement 3 of them. Based on our follow-up report and our work, we found that 2 of the 3 were fully implemented and 1 was partially implemented. I'll now pause here for any questions or comments from the committee or the airport.
Questions, comments? Let's continue.
Thank you. I'll now turn it over to Jackson, who will walk us through the first couple recommendations.
Thank you, Carl. Our original audit finding, beginning on page 1 of the follow-up report, states the Denver International Airport needed to strengthen its management and oversight of the Great Hall construction project to ensure best value for the city. Our first 4 recommendations of the original report related to project delivery method selection process, procurement procedure documentation, expedited procurement procedures, and the construction manager general contractor delivery method. I will discuss all 4 recommendations before pausing for questions or comments. Recommendation 1.1, beginning on page 1 of the follow-up report, states the airport should develop and implement a project delivery method selection process. In December of 2022, the airport developed and published a procedure guide for evaluating and documenting the process of selecting a project's delivery method. We found this procedure guide is in alignment with current industry leading practices and was followed during a recently conducted project evaluation. The development and implementation of this guide reduces the risk to the city of selecting an inappropriate project delivery method that could lead to increased project costs and delays. Therefore, we consider this recommendation fully implemented. Recommendation 1.2, beginning on page 2 of the follow-up report, states the airport should follow construction procurement procedures and document steps. Airport officials took no action to implement this recommendation because they now had agreed to implement it in our original report. Without proper procedure documentation, transparency is diminished and hinders the airport's ability to show the selection process was fair, reasonable, and competitive. The airport's response to this recommendation and auditor's addendum can be found on pages 2 and 3, respectively, of the follow-up report. Recommendation 1.3, beginning on page 4 of the follow-up report, states the airport should develop construction procedures for expedited needs. While the airport updated the existing procedure guide to formalize and define a fast-track procurement process, we found the airport was inconsistently maintaining supporting documentation as outlined in its own procedure guide. As discussed on page 5 of the follow-up report, we reviewed procurement documentation for two fast-track projects and found the airport was only able to provide all key supporting documentation for one of the projects by our fieldwork testing due date. By not providing all key supporting documentation as requested, we were unable to confirm whether the airport had consistently developed and maintained supporting documentation required by its own policies and procedures. As a result, public and other stakeholders might perceive the airport as failing to be fair, open, and competitive. There's also increased risk that the airport staff might mismanage procurement process, miss required steps, or result in noncompliance with city requirements or airport standards. Therefore, we consider this recommendation partially implemented. Recommendation 1.4, beginning on page 5 of the follow-up report, states the airport should develop and implement policies and procedures for the construction manager, general contractor delivery method. As of December 2023, the airport has formalized procedures for projects using this construction delivery method. These procedures incorporate both industry-leading practices and the airport's own forms and methods developed over the years. Further, these formalized procedures include useful background information of the delivery method and reduce the risk to the city of inconsistent performance of projects. Therefore, we consider this recommendation fully implemented. I'd like to open up the floor for any questions or comments from the airport or our committee members.
Questions? Phil?
I'm going to ask Michael Sheehan to talk about some of the recommendations. I think recommendation 1.2 and 1.3.
Yeah, so starting with 1.2, we just want to know we actually agree with that, but we can't go back in time and do something that was done in the past. In 2019, under a previous leadership team, Dan filed the city charter, Denver revised the municipal code, and executive order 8 for competitive procurement. We invited 6 contractors, 3 elected to respond, and as part of that original audit, you all interviewed those contractors to ensure that was a competitive process. You reviewed their proposals and the information we received. So we are committed to the new procedure, which Greg will address in 1.3, which you found partially. But that process did not exist back then. And so for this unique scenario, we felt like we met the city requirements as part of that. What I will say, what I will recognize is there's no scorecards or notes from that because we sat around a table like this with a committee and we voted with a diverse staff that made up that competitive selection.
And if I could just like to comment on that, you know, I've met with our team. We, the previous command team, leadership team, as Michael said, did not memorialize that decision. They should have. But again, we can't go back and correct that. I don't know if there's a way to partially agree. I understand partial agreements are not in the lexicon here, but I agree that it should have been memorialized. It was not, but we can't go back and fix that.
Regarding 1.3 recommendation, first of all, we appreciate the feedback on that. We looked at our procedures and modified our standard operating procedures. We stood that new process up in July of 2023. As mentioned, we've had 2 expedited procurements since standing that up. When you requested for documentation, we made a mistake in submitting 1 score sheet for both of those procurements. It was a duplicate. We also didn't include all the conflict of interest forms because some of the panel members weren't able to participate, but they had already signed up and filled out the conflict of interest forms. Once we had a clarifying conversation with you, we circled back, got the appropriate documentation, and we submitted that to you. So we feel that 1.3 is fully implemented at this point.
Well,
go ahead, Jim.
I guess I've got a couple overriding questions. If I could ask each of the four of you, what's the largest project other than what's going on at the airport now that you've ever overseen prior to this?
Well, I've, as the former CEO of RTD, I've overseen the Fast Tracks program, and I've also overseen...
How large was it?
$6.9 billion.
I see.
After that, I overseen the $20 billion Los Angeles construction program.
Fair enough.
For me personally, managing a project, I managed the West Corridor under Fast Tracks. So that was a $750 million program that I managed myself. At Den, I manage our whole capital improvement plan, so about $3 billion.
But not in the terminal. It's mostly on the airfield?
Including all projects at the airport.
It's worth noting when this project originally kicked off, I was with the Department of Public Works in a program oversight role where we supported the National Western, the Public Works team staffed that program along with the Elevate Denver Bond program and the other programs that Public Works supported. And then I made the move to the airport in the late 18 and then was brought into this project in 19. But the largest project that I have overseen is about a $50 million design build project that was developed of a campus with multiple facilities.
50 million?
Yeah. Okay, and then prior to that, I did work at the airport as a contract employee back in the late 90s and was part of a large terminal expansion on the curbsides out there under a contract staff.
Mr. Blumenthal, I oversee the procurement of all the contracts at the airport, both revenue contracts and expenditure contracts. I've been doing that for 15 years. On average, from an expenditure standpoint, we execute roughly $2 to $3 billion a year.
Okay. Well, I've got a follow-up question, and that is this. There are a number of $2 billion is a lot of money, especially, you know, when you've got a terminal going on and I recognize that you inherited some events and contracts that, you know, might have been done differently. I guess from your perspective, having gone through that, what gave rise, in your opinion, for the failure to have documented what should have been documented?
As was mentioned, my team wasn't part of that procurement process for the Great Hall.
It was not?
It was not.
I see. Okay, so I guess the question is, we got a $2 billion project, and the audit department found, you know, 10 recommendations, of which 70% you didn't agree with. And I guess the question is, and with such a large project, did you undertake to, if you disagreed with the audit department, to hire another firm to do a similar audit to see whether the auditors were all wet or not, you know, such as Deloitte or, you know, some other consulting firm to see whether what you did not agree to implement was reasonable. In other words, you disagreed with the audit department, but on a huge project like this, my question is, Did you have somebody else come in and see whether they agreed with you or with the auditors?
Yeah. As I said in my opening statement, we are in the process of doing that right now, bringing in other audit services, on-call construction audit services, we'll continue to do that. We do believe that there are some improvements that we can make. As we go through these findings, we will lay out why we may not disagree with one here or there. The lack of being able to or not being able to partially agree, I think, is a detriment as well, because some of these we do partially agree. But, you know, that's not the rule, I guess. If you don't agree with everything, we can't say we partially agree. But it's not that we are pushing back on the other seven, because we do partially agree with many of those. But we are bringing on those services to help us.
When do you think those services, because this project is going to go on for still another 4 years, right?
Less.
That's a long time.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. When are you planning to have those other services on board?
Well, right now, we've executed one on-call contract to support the services, and they're on board right now. We will bring on, I believe it's three more audit firms to help us with this as well.
I appreciate the spirit that you bring to the table today, so thank you. On 1.2, was it 1.2? About documenting the decisions that were made. I mean, I'm hearing you say you absolutely agree with that. I don't understand why, at the end of the original audit report, you disagreed.
In looking at this and looking at the follow-up report, I think we're flexible. I'm flexible. I can't explain what the thought process was in not memorializing it when the decision was made. And I don't like second guessing folks, because I wasn't here.
Right.
But what I will say is that, I'm used to memorializing decisions with regard to approving contractors. And so I think that should have been done.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. To the agree or disagree or partially agree, that's in the law.
Oh, okay.
So we're all bound by that. It's in the municipal code. Maybe you could say if we could partially agree, we would have partially agreed. Okay. Should we continue? Yeah, Carl?
Brian, if I might provide a response to Mr. Haggerty's response.
Sure.
For 1.3. Our audits, we have a finite timeline, right? And so we're trying to meet deadlines and get to audit committee and report out. There just wasn't enough time to have that discussion beforehand. I wanted to point that out, and then also, you know, Mr. Haggerty indicated he did provide us documentation after the fact, and we didn't review it as part of the audit, but we did look at it. Just based on our high-level review, we still think that there is still, it's still a partial implementation. The documents that he initially gave us, the airport gave us, indicated that there were three people on one of the projects we tested that were a fast-track project. When we looked at the memo that kind of codified the selection of the vendor, that memo also indicated there were three people on the panel that voted. It wasn't until we got the scorecard, which was, recent, and after we had drafted the report, that we saw that there were only two people on that panel. So we just wanted to ensure that, There's still a discrepancy that we noted in looking at those documents. And so that's the reason why we still believe it's still partially implemented.
Yeah, can I comment to that?
Please.
So thank you. I appreciate that. And we take full accountability of not meeting deadlines, okay? So we had a conversation around that as well. So we appreciate that, and we'll own that, and certainly try to do better. Human process, per city charter and ordinance, isn't a straightforward, simple process. It's pretty complicated. And in the context of panel members, they're not getting compensated per se for this. And part of our panel composition are community members. And in not many cases, but it does happen whereby as we continue to go through the procurement process, panel members' personal issues arise, they have other priorities, and they can't serve, right? So, I'd like to maybe go back and look at what documents you were looking at that were approved by our executive order to go forward with this panel. I support that. And then going through time, when those panel members dropped out, right? So before we give any panel member a proposal, they go through training. And within that training, they have to sign this conflict of interest form. So I'd like to see the feedback and align ourselves on that so that we're on the same page. But at this point in time, from the documents I've seen, I believe we're fully implemented.
Can I ask another question and follow up?
Sure.
You know, all the audit committee members are not compensated a great deal. And a number of us serve on nonprofit boards where we're not compensated. That doesn't mean that we don't have an obligation to serve as though we were being paid. So I guess the question that I have is, who's appointing these community members? And then I guess the question is, if you need a panel of three and you're not sure that you can, do you have a pool of five to deal with those issues? And I mean, it's just, I'm not blaming you personally, please understand what I'm saying, but it's kind of, $2 billion is a lot of money. These contracts all involve a lot of money. And if community members aren't going to do their jobs, they shouldn't be taking those jobs, and they ought to be dismissed and replaced. So who's appointing those community members?
Yeah, so we go through a process with our culture and strategy team on community members who are willing and able to serve, right? And as I mentioned before, it's a small amount that drop out, but it does occur. Life happens, and we have to make adjustments. So we work with them on reaching out to community members. They do it exactly as you articulated. They do a great job of it. They're very engaged into that process. A lot of times they're interested in doing work at the airport, so it's a great lens to look at how I put forth the proposal at the airport. How do I participate in that? So we believe we have a really good, robust program in getting community members involved in our panel. And like I said, the majority of them do a terrific job and push it right over the line. And then others happen. And in this case, it happened where a panel member had to bow out for personal reasons.
Okay, thank you. Before we continue, I mean, we also had overseeing the subcontracting process was something you disagreed with the original audit. Where we cite the general contractor awards themselves a contract without going through the bidding process, to our knowledge. Do you still disagree with you don't have a responsibility to oversee the subcontracting processes?
I 100% we agree we have a responsibility in overseeing the contracting process. This was one where the way that the audit finding was written, the test that was used, we disagreed with. And so that's why we disagreed with the finding.
Yeah, what I'll note is part of finding 1.4, which you approved, we detailed in here our role of oversight of the subcontracting process, self-performed, and the payment application process all laid out in what we do, because it's always a very fine line that we are overseeing it, but we're not the ones accountable for it. My job is to hold that general contractor accountable for it, to making sure they're having a fair, competitive process. In regards to self-performed, we have memorialized that, which is they give us a sealed bid the day before, which we hold so that once they do receive the bids, then we evaluate. Keep in mind, and the one thing I'll note, on a typical roadway contract, which this is obviously not, many times will require the general contractor, the prime, to do a certain percentage of the work because you want them to have that ownership, and it's a rather high percentage. We're on vertical construction, that's typically not the case. And in this case, it's a very small percentage, and we're talking doors, hardware, which is very hard to get people to bid. And then it was structural concrete. So it was a very low percentage. We've memorialized that moving forward to make sure it's a competitive number. And it comes down to this contractor who, in my humble opinion, has gone above and beyond with 592 outreach events to date. Again, that's 592 outreach events, with the latest one, 3 o'clock this afternoon at the Green Valley Rec Center, where they're trying to educate that bidding community to pursue this work, but we can't force it. So if we don't get three bids, or we don't get any bids, or if we get one erroneous bid, we have that option to leverage them to go and do that work. Because quite honestly, the time that would take to find those bids, we would do more harm than good in delaying the project and potentially impacting our schedule.
So this would be partially agree if that option was available.
Yeah.
Yes, fully agree with that.
We should have changed the law to make that.
I'll let you handle that one. Should we continue?
Thank you. Alexander will now present the status of three recommendations made in the original report. The airport did not agree to implement before pausing for questions or comments.
Thank you, Jeff. We have three recommendations in the original report, which related to subcontractor awards. Airport officials did not agree with those recommendations. We confirmed with officials that no effort was made towards implementing them, and then did no additional testing. I'll now describe those recommendations and the remaining risks. Recommendation 1.5, beginning on page 6 of our follow-up report, states the Denver International Airport should oversee the subcontracting process. Airport officials took no action to implement this recommendation because they did not agree to it. As such, the city's ability to ensure it receives quality subcontracted construction work at reasonable costs is limited. The airport's response to this recommendation and an auditor's addendum can be found on pages 6 through 17 of the follow-up report. Recommendation 1.6, beginning on the bottom of page 17 of our follow-up report, says the Denver International Airport should oversee multi-tiered subcontractor work. Airport officials took no action to implement this recommendation because they did not agree to it. This left the risk that the airport cannot ensure contract terms to follow. Which can result in overpayments. The airport's response to this recommendation and an auditor's addendum can be found on pages 17 and 19 of the follow-up report. Recommendation 1.7, beginning on page 19 of the follow-up report, states the Denver International Airport should oversee contractors' awards for self. Airport officials took no action to implement this recommendation because they did not agree to it. As a result, the risk remains that the airport may not receive the best value when the contractors self-perform work. The airport's response to this recommendation and an auditor's addendum can be found on pages 19 through 29 of the follow-up report. I'd like to open the floor for any questions or comments from the airport or audit committee members.
Any comments from the airport?
Yeah, I'm going to ask Michael Sheehan to touch on some of these, and then I want to add some color as well.
I would say with a couple of those, we partially agree with if that was an option, because again, detail, subcontracting process, and which the team reviewed and approved as part of finding 1.4. For example, with the subcontracting, again, we can't necessarily review three bids. We can communicate this to the world as we have with the 592 events led by the general contractor, not us, them. They own this. We can't force people to bid it. There is, keep in mind, with the security requirements and the clearance and mobilizing out at the airport, something, this is not unique to Great Hall. It's something we struggle a bit with all of our projects, and that's making sure we get competitive bids and we get multiple bidders. There's nothing better than having multiple bidders to get best value. Another part of that finding when it comes to subcontracting process is we cannot tell our general contractor they must take the lowest bid. They own the liability and the risk with this project, not us. And that was another part of 1.5 that we disagreed with. They owe us a recommendation. They own that responsibility and that risk to manage. And they have to state it and memorialize, which we clarified in here, what they need to include in that recommendation back to us, which we review to make sure we don't object to. Again, we want a fair, open process and competitive, but we're not going to dictate to them how they do their business. Otherwise, we own the risk with the budget and the schedule. With 1.6, we disagreed with the multi-tiered, the pyramided markup that was implied. We reviewed this very closely, and we found no indications of that. And again, we have clarified that throughout this to make sure it's clearly documented in the backup the general contractor provides to us to make sure that's not happening. With 1.7, self-performed, as I noted, also previously, they need to provide a sealed bid in advance. That's standard practice throughout. And a number of CMGCs. The animal shelter was a CMGC for the city. The crime lab was a CMGC. The GC providing that sealed bid in advance is a requirement. Could there be occasion where we're expecting bids and nobody bids? Yeah. That happens. Again, we're doing everything we can to get interested in this project. As I've said, I really feel we've gone above and beyond in any other project you look at. You get competition on these packages when they go out, but we can't always require that. But we do have the process for self-performed, clearly documented in our SOP.
Thank you.
Yes, it's more of a clarifying question than anything else. It has to do with 1.5, the three bids. As we reviewed the contract, it's not required in the contract. Now, mentioning and reemphasizing what Michael talked about in terms of bids, due to our environment, there are some firms that just do not meet the requirements, whether that's background checks or whatever. But if the contract does not require the three bids, there was a comment that it's sort of a best practice in some auditor manual. I think we get pinged for not following the contract. And so that's what I see here. It's not required in the contract. We did not require it. We didn't do it. But in the write-up, it says we should have done it because it's in some auditor handbook somewhere. And so that concerns me. The second piece of this, I think, is part of 1.5 as well. Talking about subcontractors exceeding bid proposal amounts. This is a case, and I try to narrow these things down to the common denominator. And I was talking to our folks a couple of days ago. If we are remodeling our house and we bring in a contractor and they have an estimate, and they walk in and say, "You know, we have this estimate, but when you move the stove, we found more work that has to be done, and it costs $100 more to do."
Do we go out and say, we're not going to pay the $100, we are going to re-procure the whole thing, which will take plenty of time, or do we add the $100? This is what this is. This is kind of what we did. We had a contractor, they came in, we found that there was more scope work that was required when we had the contractor there, and we added that additional amount to the contract. I think if we re-procure everything, if we find more scope, we would never get this project done. Because re-procuring takes weeks and months, if you will. So I just wanted to put that on the table, with regard to this is a real world job that we're doing, $2 billion. And so some of this, you know, I think, has to pass the reality test.
Carl, do you have any response?
Yeah, for sure. In response to, you know, Mr. Washington's comment on the lack of competitive bidding, that section of 1.5, I think we didn't note in the report, and it states as much in our rebuttal, that we said it was a contractual requirement. And as Mr. Washington notes, it did come from the criteria that we used. So, you know, in our line of work, we look to best practices, lean practices, that type of thing. And that is a recommendation that came from there. In response to the subcontracts exceeded bid proposal amounts, I believe it was more so on, we couldn't validate when this happens, because there wasn't enough documentation for us to look at and validate that it got proper approval and it went through the process. So I think that was the bigger issue with that one.
Thank you. Should we continue?
She will now present the status of the remaining recommendations from the original audit report.
Thank you, Alex. The airport disagreed with the final three recommendations, which were to validate and reconcile project allowances, appropriately use project allowances, and verify general condition billing rates. I will discuss each of these recommendations before pausing for questions and comments from the airport and audit committee members. Recommendation 1.8 states the airport should validate and reconcile project allowances. And recommendation 1.9 states the airport should appropriately use project allowances. These recommendations are discussed on pages 29 and 35 of the follow-up report. Airport officials did not agree to implement these recommendations, and we confirmed the airport has not taken any action since then to implement them. As such, the risk remains that by not requiring contractors to submit documentation of actual costs that can be validated and reconciled with project allowances, limits the airport's ability to ensure it does not overpay for work. The airport's original response to recommendation 1.8 with the auditor's addendum can be found on pages 30 through 35 of the follow-up report. And the airport's original response to recommendation 1.9 with the auditor's addendum can be found on pages 35 through 36 of the follow-up report. Finally, recommendation 1.10 states the airport should verify general condition billing rates. It begins on page 36 of the follow-up report. Airport officials did not agree to implement this recommendation, and we confirmed no action has been taken since then to implement it. As such, the risk remains that by not maintaining detailed documentation related to general condition costs, the airport cannot determine whether these costs are reasonable or allowable. As a result, the airport may pay the contractor for costs that are unallowable. The airport's original response to recommendation 1.10 with the auditor's addendum can be found on pages 37 through 39 of the follow-up report. This concludes our presentation of the Great Hall Construction follow-up report. I would now like to open the floor for any questions or comments from the airport and audit committee members.
Any questions from the committee? Any comments from the airport?
Yeah, I would say if the option again was on the table, we partially agreed with 1.8, 1.9. Again, we detailed our process in here. Where we got hung up in the audit recommendations was there was a suggestion or was implied that all allowances be tracked by time and material. That would create a tremendous burden on us at that level, so many times it might be a fixed price or a lump sum that makes it much more manageable for us. This is a tool that we leverage heavily, obviously, in a dynamic environment of an operating terminal with our passenger traffic exceeding 80 million. And a great example of that is wayfinding. Wayfinding is constantly evolving in the terminal, and we can constantly improve that and add that day to day. That's a great example of where we might have an allowance with this. So we have memorialized that process as part of this. It is a mechanism that's allowable within the contract, and we feel that we are very much within the confines of the contract for both 1.8 and 1.9. And what we were guilty of originally, where we needed to up our game, was in our documentation of that. So we track that. We have that memorialized here in our SOP. 1.10, I did want to touch on briefly. What we can stand behind this is we did get three bids for this project when it went out, and all of them were in range of each other very closely and very competitive. And when this audit originally happened, we sent the audit team to the general contractor. We refused to provide this information. So we feel from competitive nature that this project was awarded, and seeing those rates from all three, they were all very competitive, and it was competitive and something we could stand behind.
Okay. Thank you. You're going to have construction going on out there for decades to come in the future. I know we'll be there with you. I hope that these audit recommendations can help improve the process for all of us.
May I make a closing statement? Yeah, thank you for that. And you know, we want to improve our processes. What I will say, without getting into the discussion of the old schedule versus the revised schedule and all of that, the revised schedule, the commitment that I made to the city council on the schedule that I presented, we are ahead of that schedule. And we will remain ahead of that schedule, and we will finish the Great Hall ahead of schedule. With the opening of the new East Security ahead of schedule in the next 6 to 7 months, looking just a twin of the West Security area. So I just want to leave that with the Audit Committee. This job is actually going very, very well. Now, there is some administrivia that we have to figure out. That's a word that I created a couple of weeks ago. Yes, the documentation on these big projects are always a challenge. They always are. The main objective is to get the Great Hall finished ahead of schedule. And I feel like we will do that. The last thing I'll say is, even though we have a number of large construction projects in the works that we're doing right now, a consolidated rental car facility, we're moving towards expansion of C Concourse, those things, these will not be customer-facing projects. The customer-facing project is the Great Hall, and that is almost done, and it will be ahead of schedule.
Thank you. While you're here, I have a question that doesn't relate to the Great Hall or any of the terminals or concourses, rather. Pena Boulevard.
Yes.
Is there anything to expand Pena Boulevard in the future?
We are going through the NEPA process, the National Environmental Policy Act process. We do not want to predetermine what the outcome of that NEPA process will be. I can't tell you what it looks like or what it will be, but I will commit that we are going to expedite that NEPA process, that environmental process, as fast as we can. It includes a lot of community input, but we'll get to a preferred alternative that the community will provide feedback for. But I see that progressing as well.
Because those 82 million customers, some of them are out on Peña Boulevard. A lot of them are out on Peña.
They all are, actually.
Sure are. Sure are. I will say that we initiated a mobility study, which is complete. In that mobility study, that feeds into the environmental process. And we also have 20 recommendations around transit demand management, and we're looking to implement those as well.
Just out of curiosity, because I take the train, I don't drive to the airport, and obviously you have a partner there whom you don't control, and they've proven that time and again. Is there anything, you don't have to make this a long answer, Mr. Washington, is there anything you could pass a wand that these guys could do to make those trains and the parking and everything else more user-friendly to relieve, you know, the Peña Boulevard problem?
Are you talking about RTD?
Yeah. Oh. You got 90 seconds. I know you could talk about this for an hour, I'm sure.
We could. We meet with them frequently, and we share with them ideas that we have, but we have a really good partnership. So the answer is yes, we can pass on some ideas. And we have, and will.
Do they listen to them?
I think so. I think so. We have a unique relationship.
Yeah, I know that.
All right. Thank you very much for your participation. Our next item, we have a public report for information technology general controls audit that's been issued. It can be found on the Denver Auditor website. Our next committee meeting is Thursday, February 20th, here in the Parr Widener Room at 9 a.m. And right now, I'd like to ask for a motion to adjourn into executive session. We have discussed some confidential audit subject.
So moved.
Second. Thank you. Is there any discussion? All in favor? Say aye.
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 We're in executive session.